Looks like the Browns are out. This is Paul Rodell, once more, Oral History Project for IBS. And today is July 15th. And I'm in the home of Lou Wolf, who was a Laos volunteer 64 through 67. And, I guess that's the basic introduction. And I've already explained off tape the first question that we've been starting everybody off with, the question that could not actually be put in on the original form. And that is your own influences, where and when you were born, what your parents were like, how you were brought up, the influences on you, the youthful Lou Wolf that decided, that helped you decide that you wanted to go into this organization, IBS. So now I get to pretty much shut up, although I may chirp in from time to time, and let you tell your own story.
I grew up, I was born in 1940, actually on Halloween, grew up on a farm outside Philadelphia. In those days, it was about 30 miles outside Philadelphia. Today, it's just virtually part of Philadelphia proper, right on the Pennsylvania Turnpike. In fact, when the Turnpike came through in 1956, it sliced through our farm, and my parents sold the farm as a result, to my great dismay at the time. Growing up on a farm and having farm responsibilities, so we had my father also worked in the city, and we had somebody who farmed the farm, and I was essentially a helper. I did milking and plowing sometimes, but
gives us an amazing cup. This is not a stealth B-2 bomber cup. Is not exactly what I expect to find in your house.
it was sent to us a friend in California. I thought I'd appreciate it.
When it heats up, the thing shows up better? Is that it? I'm sorry.
All the lights start blinking.
Yeah. Bombs drop.
And loved the farm life, and the Gerald Ford, Dolores collects plates and all kinds of political plates and cups and everything. So, and essentially, I became, influence, part of the influence, I guess, although it was later on, but part of the influence was growing up in a rural situation, but going to school in the city and then coming home again. Obviously, rural Philadelphia is not the same even in the 40s and 50s as Laos, clearly. But I went to college. I went to a Quaker school, Germantown Friends School. I actually spent 14 years there, including kindergarten. I graduated in 1958 with a very mediocre achievement level. Barely graduated, actually, but got into learning along about the 11th grade, I guess. Before that, I wasn't really much interested. Ended up at Goddard College in Vermont, quite almost by accident, because at the high school they didn't tell me that even in 1958 when I graduated that I would need to have two foreign languages to graduate, to get admission rather. And
do you have to answer that?
I guess I should. Yeah.
Okay. I'll put it on pause.
Sure.
Well, let's put it back. Okay, so we were through some of the early stuff. Got you to Goddard for some reason about the two languages.
Yeah, and so Goddard was only one of, I think, six schools that in the country at that time that would accept me with no foreign language, or less than two foreign languages. And the others were out of my Claremont Men's College, which is, you have to be a genius, literally, on the scale almost, to get in there. And so that was why.
Yeah, we just run again. It's running again.
I ended up applying to Goddard, which seemed to me the place of my dreams, I guess. I went up there to look at the college, and it certainly fit my interests in academic, mediocre academic level. I mean, basically, they were, Goddard then was a very progressive school, and designed to help people to become independent thinkers, and and, you know, it had no marks, no grades, no exams. It was a very very progressive school, and of course the neighbors in the area, it's in rural Vermont.
And this would have been in
58.
Yeah.
Okay.
That is early for that kind of experimentation.
Well, they had been doing it for at least a decade before that. And it was based on this sort of John Dewey School of Education, and in fact, the president, the founder and president of the school, Tim Pitkin, who I became very close to, was an apostle of John Dewey, and anyway, to make a long story short, I really blossomed there. I became involved in both academically and in community affairs. I did a thesis on rural zoning in Vermont, which meant that I went to 8 communities all over the state.
Mm-hmm.
The college gave me a car to use to travel, you know, to visit these communities and interview people and so forth. And I've reread my thesis that I wrote then recently, and it's quite an interesting thing. And so I became very, very active and involved. One of the reasons, and I would say probably a primary reason that I was finally led to, though not specifically IBS, but to this kind of work that I ended up in Laos, was one of my professors, Alan Walker, who was a Quaker, who was his field was psychology and community development, and I got interested in community development through working with him from almost the time that I came to the school.
Mm-hmm.
And he made me start thinking internationally, which I hadn't done till then. I had been, you know, thanks to partly, I guess, to a small extent, to my education, my pre-college education, and a Quaker school here in Philadelphia, I became aware of social issues and the need to, you know, work with the community, of the fact that there were poor people. I mean, I grew up in a family where there was not poverty at all, and in fact, they were reasonably wealthy, my parents.
You mentioned your father went into Philadelphia. What did he do there?
He worked in he and his brothers founded a company that made boxes, metal edge boxes, and through the 40s and 50s, through the war, they made a lot of money, unfortunately, selling these boxes, which were the strongest boxes made, because they have metal edges down
right.
the corners. You still see them these days. Companies obviously long since sold. My father's deceased, but it was they made a lot of money in the military selling these boxes for, you know, military equipment and so forth. And that was a source of some problems between me and my parents, the fact of how the company became a success story and so forth.
Yeah.
They ended up making not only boxes, but designing machinery to make boxes, which they then sold to other people to make boxes.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my uncles, my father's brother, also, in addition to patenting these metal edge boxes, designed the handle lock bag, which is they still use today, you know, to fold
and
carry
them. Uh-huh. Right.
I guess, you know, partly because my parents sold the farm, which I was very unhappy about at the time, though I since came to accept it, but at that time, I was 16 years old when they sold it. This is obviously, I was still in high school.
Mm-hmm.
I was very upset by that. I mean, to me, that the farm represented my entire life, and I loved it very much. And then the money issue, and a lot of my parents' friends, which I just couldn't identify with, you know, very hoity-toity types of people, and then they moved to the city in Philadelphia, and so we somewhat grew apart, myself and my parents, and I wouldn't say we were totally alienated. I mean, I came home, and you know, it wasn't like that. But psychologically, there was some, you know, sort of drive to go away from home,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
which is partly again what led me to Laos.
And then that combines with the influence of this instructor at Goddard.
Absolutely, yeah. Who was a pacifist. A Quaker and a pacifist,
mm-hmm.
and started me thinking about pacifism, though not in any specific context. I think we're talking now 1959, 60, 61,
mm-hmm.
60, you know, up to 63 when I graduated.
Mm-hmm.
I got involved first in the civil rights movement. We organized a lot of support work for the civil rights movement from the school. I was one of the main organizers of an auction where we went around to the farms and communities around the school and collected, you know, voluntary contributions for this. And we used it to try and educate the local population. In Vermont, they're very independent thinkers,
mm-hmm.
have always been. Unlike the neighbor state in Hampshire, which is quite conservative, Vermonters are generally, though not all, at least liberal, if not very progressive.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, there were some very hardcore conservative people there, and when we were going around, you know, the truck, getting furniture and different things that people would give, I distinctly remember coming to one farmhouse and then the man and we called ahead and I don't know what we were told, but we got there and the man was standing on the porch with a shotgun,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, swearing at us and the goddamn niggers and all this stuff. He was a minority because most people, you know, at the time the civil rights movement was the Freedom Rides and really the activity around the civil rights movement was coming to a crescendo at that time. We raised through that auction, I forget, several $1,000, which we sent to Congress of Racial Equality and became mobilizing influence at the school, at the college, and as well as in the community. I mean, we got in the papers. It was in the Vermont papers. I think somebody picked it up on the wire that we had raised all this money for,
mm-hmm.
this auction and all. And so, unfortunately, as a footnote, quality, but it apparently got diverted somewhere along the line and didn't get to the people that, for whom it was intended. I don't quite know the story on that, but it was money. So it was received, and we got a phone call or a letter or something saying it was received, but somehow somebody pocketed it. Which was really a bummer for those of us that had worked very hard.
Oh, yeah. Much worse than the actual theft of whatever amount it was.
Then we I did a year in Denmark in a program called the Scandinavian Seminar in the summer of 60, I'm sorry, I'm doing these things out of order, and I hope you
get it right,
but 60, 61, in my, between my junior and senior, I mean my sophomore and junior year, I did a year in a program called the Scandinavian Seminar, which still is existing today, and went to Denmark, learned Danish, learned to speak and write Danish, and worked in various jobs that I had there. I went to a folk high school, which is sort of an adult school. It's long, for, you know, over 100 years of folk high school movement that's for people of all ages, literally from teens to the 90s. And
never heard of it.
It's a very popular movement throughout Scandinavia.
Huh.
And so I was in a school with a very straight-laced principal, a guy that had fought the Nazis, interestingly enough, but was very disciplinarian and very very traditional fellow. Who didn't seem to like Americans very much, I must say. I didn't really got that clear, but anyway, did pretty well there. And then I had these different jobs. I worked at Tivoli, which is the amusement park in Copenhagen. I worked at a tire warehouse, lifting tires, you know, mountains of tires. And I lived with two different families, one on a farm way up in Jutland, which is a northern island in peninsula of Denmark, and then in an island to the south of Copenhagen called Lolland Falster. I was with a doctor and his family. Worked in another job. Anyway, finally ended up there translating a book, a Danish book translated to English. And all in all, that was a very important experience in the context of IBS, because part of we got interested in there with the various people that I knew in Denmark in something in which we actually sat down and talked about setting up something called the International Development Project. We had long meetings into the night with students from all over the world, and we almost, I mean, we actually had a charter written up, I mean, it was, and then it all sort of fizzled out, but it was, for me, that experience of sitting in a very close, you know, on a face-to-face, person-to-person basis over, you know, a couple of weeks with people from India, from Latin America, from all over. And talking about, you know, putting some of our ideas into action, which I got into, as I say, through my close friendship with this professor who taught me about community development, a field of work that I'd never even heard of until I got to Goddard. That was another major influence. And then... by the time I was, that was been 1961, and believe, I don't remember the date exactly, but I got a draft notice. You might remember the lottery system that was put in place in those years. Somehow my number came up, and
I thought the lottery was later.
It might have been, I don't remember, 62 or early 63 when it finally came. I don't remember I was 21 and 61, but might have been 62 or 3. I have some files. I could look that up if you want. But
No.
I got a draft notice, and I suddenly, this got my attention because I already had a consciousness about Vietnam, very, very generalized, but already coming to the pacifist way of thinking at that time, thanks again in large part to this professor, as well as some reading, you know, Gandhi and Martin Luther King, talking about nonviolence. And so I had to meet with the draft board, and I filed for conscientious objector status.
Well, your own religious upbringing was Quaker, right?
No.
No, what?
No, not.
You mentioned the Quaker.
My parents
influence.
Were nominally, very nominally Jewish.
Oh, okay.
But the Quaker influence of high school and then with this professor, and my parents were very open. I mean, they said whatever religion or no religion, whatever you choose, we support.
Okay.
And
I just heard all these Quaker references, so I just assumed.
I was not brought up a Quaker. In fact, quite the contrary, I really became a Quaker in the formal sense when I was at Goddard. We would have we would meet in this professor's home along with about 10, 15, 20 people every Sunday morning, 11 o'clock, you know, sitting silently, you know, sitting around in a circle. And that was a profound influence on me. It really got me to, and I did a lot more reading about Quakers and then. Maybe my experience in high school for all those years, you know, where we had Quaker meeting as well, but in those years I used to sort of, I mean, it was a joke. Not a joke, but it was sort of a chore to go to a Quaker meeting. To sit and listen to one of the guys who always stood up and spoke. This is supposed to be a silent meeting, but you know, Quaker meeting, anyone can speak if the spirit moves them. And but Dr. McFedrin spoke every time, and it was so
moved a lot by the spirit.
Yeah, right. And he had to speak, and that was sort of a standing joke in the school. Just parenthetically, I and a couple of other kids in the high school in my class got so down on it that we one Thursday morning we had the meeting in the winter, and so they had the gradators were all turned on, you know, to keep the place warm. And just before a meeting, we got in the meeting house. Nobody was there when we went in. We put Limburger cheese in the radiator. So,
really?
And by the time people were gathering, it was really quite strong odor. And, you know, being a traditional institution, they decided to meet anyway, right?
Oh,
and, you know, and Dr. McFedrin just would not have it if we didn't have the meeting. And so everybody was enduring through the smell of Limburger cheese, which was strong.
Kind of backfired.
Yeah. And they never found out who did it.
Well, now you put it on the table.
Yeah, that's right.
You told
well, I had about one-third or one-fourth responsibility on all the four others, that I will say.
We can shave the sentence that you rat on your co-conspirator.
And our daughter always loves to tell this story, and I'm going to tell the others that I've told. But all of these influences came together, and then I had to really very quickly decide what to do. And I applied for, and I got my draft notes.
Well, you could at least claim the Quaker religion at that point.
Right.
Yeah.
And I wrote a very long and detailed essay about why I refused to serve in the military, refused to kill people, that I believed in nonviolence, acknowledged that, you know, the reality of the military, but that I refused to be part of it, that I would not carry a weapon or kill people. And then I had to meet with, I wrote that and sent that to the draft board and all the forms and everything. And then I had to meet the draft, you know, and they require you to be there and show up, and they talk to you. Now, being in Philadelphia, the draft board was relatively easy because there are so many Quakers there and they're used to it. But if you're in rural Idaho or in you know, New Hampshire or somewhere where they've never heard of it, yeah, Texas, exactly. People applying for CO status then as well as right up to today. I mean,
sure.
It's very hard. Some places they think you're kind of, I mean, they don't take it seriously because they don't even, they claim at least some draft boards, well, there are no draft boards today, but when you file, you still have to file for CO status. Well, it's a voluntary army, but everything's changed. But if you want to be a CO, you know, still have to go through that. It's very hard, especially for people who are in the military who realize then that they have either philosophical or religious reasons that they didn't know. I mean, a lot of people are in the military and don't know that there is any basis, legal basis, that you can be a CO. Very hard, but then there are several cases that have gone to the Supreme Court of people who refused, you know, who were in the military, and then they realized, and it's quite a, I mean, it's a major thing, although less so without the draft, much less.
Right.
I mean, once you sign up for the military, you sort of give them, sign away your rights, and there are people that face that problem. Anyway, make a long story short, I ended up having to find a job. I mean, the draft board agreed with my, said, okay, we'll give you 1-0 status, which has been as a CO. And 1-AO is with medical disability, and 1-0 is for conscientious objective status. And so I had, I think, 2 weeks or whatever it was to find a job. And I'm trying to remember, but anyway, I ended up in Indianapolis working at a social service agency called Planner House. Again, this is still there. Where I was teaching young African Americans in a ghetto environment. We had employment clinics. We set up in a sort of a role-playing situation in a little office that we had in the ghetto, and the people would come in, and the idea was to try and teach them how to apply for a job. Okay,
how to go through an interview, things
right,
like that.
Right. Okay. And probably at least half the people coming in were functionally illiterate, not entirely, but basically functionally illiterate. And some were teens, some were older. And the Planner House was almost, I was the only Caucasian working there, everyone else was black. And so my role in this role playing was the white employer. And you know, we're talking during a period when there was a lot, although it still exists, but then much, and certainly in Indiana, in Indianapolis, where a stronghold of the Ku Klux Klan, there was a lot of racism. So I would play a role of everybody knew we were, it was role playing. This is not a real situation, but
hopefully they.
One guy lost it, and he got, he forgot that, and he stood up, and he was 10, he was there, and I'm calling him a nigger. And I said, wait, but this role playing, you know, he, and he still, they had to, people restrain him, you know, because he forgot the name.
I would like that job. I mean, that would be really tough to be that kind of person when you're not.
Well, I mean, it was acting, you know,
I
as
know,
well,
but still,
I mean, because before we started the role playing,